a disturbance of those primitive parts of the brain which govern go and drive. In Parkinsonism, which affects motion but not action as such, the disturbance lies in the midbrain and its connections. In chorea, which is a chaos of fragmentary quasi-actions, the disorder lies in the higher levels of the basal ganglia. In Tourette's, where there is excitement of the emotions and the passions, a disorder of the primal instinctual bases of behavior, the disturbance seems to lie in the very highest parts of the old brain, the thalamus, hypothalamus, limbic system, and amygdala, where the basic affective and instinctual determinants of personality are lodged. Thus, Tourette's, pathologically no less than clinically, constitutes a sort of missing link between body and mind, and lies, so to speak, between chorea and mania. As in the rare hyperkinetic forms of encephalitis lethargica, and in all post-encephalitic patients overexcited by L-DOPA, patients with Tourette syndrome, or Tourettism from any other cause, strokes, cerebral tumors, intoxications, or infections, seem to have an excess of exciter transmitters in the brain, especially the transmitter dopamine. And as lethargic Parkinsonian patients need more dopamine to arouse them, as my post-encephalitic patients were awakened by the dopamine precursor L-DOPA, so frenetic and Touretic patients must have had their dopamine lowered by a dopamine antagonist, such as the drug haloperidol, Haldol. On the other hand, there is not just a surfeit of dopamine in the Touretter's brain, as there is not just a deficiency of it in the Parkinsonian brain. There are also much subtler and more widespread changes, as one would expect in a disorder which may alter personality. There are countless subtle paths of abnormality which differ from patient to patient and from day to day in any one patient. Haldol can be an answer to Tourette's, but neither it nor any other drug can be the answer, any more than L-DOPA is the answer to Parkinsonism. Complementary to any purely medicinal or medical approach, there must also be an existential approach. In particular, a sensitive understanding of action, art, and play as being, in essence, healthy and free, and thus antagonistic to crude drives and impulsions, to the blind force of the subcortex from which these patients suffer. The motionless Parkinsonian can sing and dance, and when he does so is completely free from his Parkinsonism. And when the galvanized Touretter sings, plays, or acts, he in turn is completely liberated from his Tourette's. Here the I vanquishes and reigns over the it. Between 1973 and his death in 1977, I enjoyed the privilege of corresponding with the great neuropsychologist A.R. Luria, and often sent him observations and tapes on Tourette's. In one of his last letters, he wrote to me, "This is truly of a tremendous importance. Any understanding of such a syndrome must vastly broaden our understanding of human nature in general. I know of no other syndrome of comparable interest." When I first saw Ray, he was 24 years old and almost incapacitated by multiple tics of extreme violence coming in volleys every few seconds. He had been subject to these since the age of 4, and severely stigmatized by the attention they aroused, though his high intelligence, his wit, his strength of character and sense of reality enabled him to pass successfully through school and college, and to be valued and loved by a few friends and his wife. Since leaving college, however, he had been fired from a dozen jobs, always because of tics, never for incompetence. Was continually in crises of one sort and another, usually caused by his impatience, his pugnacity, and his coarse, brilliant chutzpah. And it found his marriage threatened by involuntary cries of fuck, shit, and so on, which would burst from him at times of sexual excitement. He was, like many Touretters, remarkably musical, and could scarcely have survived, emotionally or economically, had he not been a weekend jazz drummer of real virtuosity, famous for his sudden and wild extemporizations, which would arise from a tick or a compulsive hitting of a drum, and would instantly be made the nucleus of a wild and wonderful improvisation, so that the sudden intruder would be turned to brilliant advantage. His Tourette's was also of advantage in various games, especially ping-pong, at which he excelled partly in consequence of his abnormal quickness of reflex and reaction, but especially, again, because of improvisations. Very sudden, nervous, frivolous shots, in his own words, which were so unexpected and startling as to be virtually unanswerable. The only time he was free from tics was in post-coital quiescence or in sleep, or when he swam, or sang, or worked, evenly and rhythmically, and found a kinetic melody, a play which was tension-free, tic-free, and free. Under an ebullient, eruptive, clownish surface, he was a deeply serious man, and a man in despair. He had never heard of the TSA, which indeed scarcely existed at the time, nor had he heard of Haldol. He had diagnosed himself as having Tourette's after reading the article on tics in the Washington Post. When I confirmed the diagnosis and spoke of using Haldol, he was excited but cautious. I made a test of Haldol by injection, and he proved extraordinarily sensitive to it, becoming virtually tick-free for a period of 2 hours after I had administered no more than 1/8 of a milligram. After this auspicious trial, I started him on Haldol, prescribing a dose of 1/4 of a milligram 3 times a day. He came back the following week with a black eye and a broken nose and said, "So much for your fucking Haldol." Even this minute dose, he said, had thrown him off balance, interfered with his speed, his timing, his preternaturally quick reflexes. Like many Tourette's, he was attracted to spinning things, and to revolving doors in particular, which he would dodge in and out of like lightning. He had lost this knack on the Haldol, had mistimed his movements, and had been bashed on the nose. Further, many of his tics, far from disappearing, had simply become slow and enormously extended. He might get transfixed in mid-tic, as he put it, and find himself in almost catatonic postures. Ferenczi once called catatonia the opposite of tics, and suggested these be called cataclonia. He presented a picture, even on this minute dose, of marked Parkinsonism, dystonia, catatonia, and psychomotor block. In reaction which seemed inauspicious in the extreme, suggesting not insensitivity, but such oversensitivity, such pathological sensitivity, that perhaps he could only be thrown from one extreme to another, from acceleration and Tourette-ism to catatonia and Parkinsonism, with no possibility of any happy medium. He was understandably discouraged by this experience and this thought, and also by another thought which he now expressed. "Suppose you could take away the tics," he said. "What would be left? I consist of tics, there is nothing else." He seemed, at least jokingly, to have little sense of his identity except as a ticker. He called himself the ticker of President's Broadway, and spoke of himself in the third person as Witty Ticky Ray, adding that he was so prone to ticky witticisms and witty ticicisms that he scarcely knew whether it was a gift or a curse. He said he could not imagine life without Tourette's, nor was he sure he would care for it. I was strongly reminded at this point of what I had encountered in some of my post-encephalitic patients, who were inordinately sensitive to L-DOPA. I had nevertheless observed in their case that such extreme physiological sensitivities and instabilities might be transcended if it were possible for the patient to lead a rich and full life, that the existential balance or poise of such a life might overcome a severe physiological imbalance. feeling that Ray also had such possibilities in him, that, despite his own words, he was not incorrigibly centered on his own disease in an exhibitionistic or narcissistic way, I suggested that we meet weekly for a period of 3 months. During this time, we would try to imagine life without Tourette's. We would explore, if only in thought and feeling, how much life could offer him without the perverse attractions and attentions of Tourette's. We would examine the role and economic importance of Tourette's to him and how he might get on without these. We would explore all this for 3 months and then make another trial of Haldol. There followed 3 months of deep and patient exploration, in which, often against much resistance and spite and lack of faith in self and life, all sorts of healthy and human potentials came to light. Potentials which had somehow survived 20 years of severe Tourette's and Tourette-y life, hidden in the deepest and strongest core of the personality. This deep exploration was exciting and encouraging in itself and gave us, at least, a limited hope. What in fact happened exceeded all our expectations and showed itself to be no mere flash in the pan, but an enduring and permanent transformation of reactivity. For when I again tried Ray on Haldol, in the same minute dose as before, he now found himself tick-free, but without significant ill effects. And he has remained this way for the past 9 years. The effects of Haldol here were miraculous, but only became so when a miracle was allowed. Its initial effects were close to catastrophic, partly no doubt on a physiological basis, but also because any cure or relinquishing of Tourette's at this time would have been premature and economically impossible. Having had Tourette's since the age of 4, Ray had no experience of any normal life. He was heavily dependent on his exotic disease, and not unnaturally employed and exploited it in various ways. He had not been ready to give up his Tourette's, and, I cannot help thinking, might never have been ready without those 3 months of intense preparation, of tremendously hard and concentrated deep analysis and thought. The past 9 years, on the whole, have been happy ones for Ray, a liberation beyond any possible expectation. After 20 years of being confined by Tourette's and compelled to this and that by its crude physiology, he enjoys a spaciousness and freedom he would never have thought possible, or at most, during our analysis, only theoretically possible. His marriage is tender and stable, and he is now a father as well. He has many good friends who love and value him as a person, and not simply as an accomplished Tourette-ic clown. He plays an important part in his local community, and he holds a responsible position at work. Yet, problems remain. Problems perhaps inseparable from having Tourette's and Haldol. During his working hours and working week, Ray remains sober, solid, square on Haldol. This is how he describes his Haldol self. He is slow and deliberate in his movements and judgments, with none of the impatience, the impetuosity he showed before Haldol, but equally none of the wild improvisations and inspirations. Even his dreams are different in quality. Straight wish fulfillment, he says, with none of the elaborations, the extravaganzas of Tourette's. He is less sharp, less quick in repartee, no longer bubbling with witty tics or ticky wit. He no longer enjoys or excels at ping pong or other games. He no longer feels that urgent killer instinct, the instinct to win, to beat the other man. He is less competitive then, and also less playful, and he has lost the impulse or the knack of sudden, frivolous moves which take everyone by surprise. He has lost his obscenities, his coarse chutzpah, his spunk. He has come to feel increasingly that something is missing. Most important, and disabling because this was vital for him as a means of both support and self-expression, he found that on Haldol he was musically dull, average, competent but lacking energy, enthusiasm, extravagance, and joy. He no longer had tics or compulsive hitting of the drums, but he no longer had wild and creative surges. As this pattern became clear to him, and after discussing it with me, Ray made a momentous decision. He would take Haldol dutifully throughout the working week, but would take himself off it and let fly at weekends. This he has done for the past 3 years. So now there are two Rays, on and off Haldol. There is the sober citizen, the calm deliberator from Monday to Friday, and there is witty, ticky Ray, frivolous, frenetic, inspired at weekends. It is a strange situation, as Ray is the first to admit. Having Tourette's is wild, like being drunk all the while. Being on Haldol is dull, makes one square and sober, and neither state is really free. You normals, who have the right transmitters in the right places at the right times in your brains, have all feelings, all styles, available all the time. Gravity, levity, whatever is appropriate. We Touretters don't. We are forced into levity by our Tourette's, and forced into gravity when we take Haldol. You are free. You have a natural balance. We must make the best of an artificial balance. Ray does make the best of it, and has a full life, despite Tourette's, despite Haldol, despite the unfreedom and the artifice, despite being deprived of that birthright of natural freedom which most of us enjoy. But he has been taught by his sickness, and in a way he has transcended it. He would say, with Nietzsche, "I have traversed many kinds of health, and keep traversing them. And as for sickness, are we not almost tempted to ask whether we could get along without it? Only great pain is the ultimate liberator of the spirit." Paradoxically, Ray, deprived of natural animal physiological health, has found a new health, a new freedom, through the vicissitudes he is subject to. He has achieved what Nietzsche liked to call the great health. Rare humor, valor, and resilience of spirit, despite being or because he is afflicted with Tourette's. Chapter 11. Cupid's Disease. A bright woman of 90, Natasha Kay, recently came to our clinic. Soon after her 88th birthday, she said she noticed a change. "What sort of change?" we queried. "Delightful," she exclaimed. "I thoroughly enjoyed it. I felt more energetic, more alive. I felt young once again. I took an interest in the young men. I started to feel, you might say, frisky. Yes, frisky." This was a problem. "No, not at first. I felt well, extremely well. Why should I think anything was the matter? And then?" "My friends started to worry. First they said, 'You look radiant, a new lease on life.' But then they started to think it was not quite appropriate. 'You were always so shy,' they said, 'and now you're a flirt. You giggle, you tell jokes. At your age, is that right?' And how did you feel?" I was taken aback. I'd been carried along, and it didn't occur to me to question what was happening. But then I did. I said to myself, 'You're 89, Natasha. This has been going on for a year. You were always so temperate in feeling. And now this extravagance. You are an old woman nearing the end. What could justify such a sudden euphoria?' and as soon as I thought of euphoria, things took on a new complexion. "You're sick, my dear," I said to myself. "You're feeling too well. You have to be ill."
Ill emotionally, mentally ill?
No, not emotionally, physically ill. It was something in my body, my brain, that was making me high. And then I thought, God damn it. It's Cupid's disease.
Cupid's disease? I echoed blankly. I had never heard of the term before.
Yes, Cupid's disease. Syphilis, you know. I was in a brothel in Salonika nearly 70 years ago. I caught syphilis. Lots of the girls had it. We called it Cupid's disease. My husband saved me, took me out, had it treated. That was years before penicillin, of course. Could it have caught up with me after all these years?
There may be an immense latent period between the primary infection and the advent of neurosyphilis, especially if the primary infection has been suppressed, not eradicated. I had one patient treated with Salvarsan by Ehrlich himself who developed tabes dorsalis, one form of neurosyphilis, more than 50 years later. But I had never heard of an interval of 70 years, nor of a self-diagnosis of cerebral syphilis mooted so calmly and clearly.
"That's an amazing suggestion," I replied after some thought.
"It would never have occurred to me, but perhaps you are right."
She was right. The spinal fluid was positive. She did have neurosyphilis. It was indeed the spirochete stimulating her ancient cerebral cortex. Now the question of treatment arose. But here another dilemma presented itself, propounded with typical acuity by Mrs. K herself. "I don't know that I want it treated," she said. "I know it's an illness, but it's made me feel well. I've enjoyed it. I still enjoy it. I won't deny it. It's made me feel livelier, friskier than I have in 20 years. It's been fun. But I know when a good thing goes too far and stops being good. I've had thoughts. I've had impulses, I won't tell you, which are, well, embarrassing and silly. It was like being a little tiddly, a little tipsy at first. But if it goes any further..."
She mimed a drooling, spastic dement.
"I guessed I had Cupid's. That's why I came to you. I don't want it to get worse. That would be awful. But I don't want it cured. That would be just as bad. I wasn't fully alive until the Wrigley's got me. Do you think you could keep it just as it is?"
We thought for a while, and our course, mercifully, was clear. We have given her penicillin, which has killed the spirochetes, but can do nothing to reverse the cerebral changes, the disinhibitions they have caused. And now Mrs. K has it both ways, enjoying a mild disinhibition, a release of thought and impulse, without any threat to her self-control or of further damage to her cortex. She hopes to live thus reanimated, rejuvenated, to 100.
"Funny thing," she says. "You've got to give it to Cupid."
Postscript. Very recently, I have seen some of these same dilemmas and ironies in relation to another patient, Miguel O., admitted to the state hospital with a diagnosis of mania, but soon realized to be suffering from the excited stage of neurosyphilis. A simple man, he had been a farmhand in Puerto Rico, and with some speech and hearing impediment, he could not express himself too well in words, but expressed himself, exhibited his situation, simply and clearly in drawings. The first time I saw him, he was quite excited, and when I asked him to copy a simple figure, he produced, with great brio, a three-dimensional elaboration, or so I took it to be, until he explained that it was an open carton, and then tried to draw some fruit in it. Impulsively inspired by his excited imagination, he had ignored the circle and cross, but retained and made concrete the idea of enclosure. An open carton, a carton full of oranges, was that not more exciting, more alive, more real than my dull figure? A few days later I saw him again, very energized, very active, thoughts and feelings flying everywhere, high as a kite. I asked him again to draw the same figure. And now, impulsively, without pausing for a moment, he transformed the original to a sort of trapezoid, a lozenge, and then attached to this a string and a boy.
"Boy flying kite! Kite's flying!" he exclaimed excitedly.
I saw him for the third time a few days after this, and found him rather down, rather Parkinsonian. He had been given Haldol to quiet him, while awaiting final tests on the spinal fluid. Again, I asked him to draw the figure, and this time he copied it dully, correctly, and a little smaller than the original. The micrographia of Haldol. And with none of the elaborations, the animation, the imagination of the others.
"I don't see things anymore," he said. "It looked so real. It looked so alive before. Will everything seem dead when I am treated?"
The drawings of patients with Parkinsonism, as they are awakened by L-DOPA, form an instructive analogy. Asked to draw a tree, the Parkinsonian tends to draw a small, meager thing, stunted, impoverished, a bare winter tree with no foliage at all. As he warms up, comes to, is animated by L-DOPA, so the tree acquires vigor, life, imagination, and foliage. If he becomes too excited, high on L-DOPA, the tree may acquire a fantastic ornateness and exuberance, exploding with the fluorescence of new branches and foliage with little arabesques, curlicues, and whatnot, until finally its original form is completely lost beneath this enormous, this baroque elaboration. Such drawings are also rather characteristic of Tourette's. The original form, the original thought, lost in a jungle of embellishment, and in the so-called speed art of amphetaminism. First the imagination is awakened, then excited, frenzied, to endlessness and excess. What a paradox, what a cruelty, what an irony there is here, that inner life and imagination may lie dull and dormant unless released, awakened by an intoxication or disease. Precisely this paradox lay at the heart of awakenings. It is responsible, too, for the seduction of Tourette's, and, no doubt, for the peculiar uncertainty which may attach to a drug like cocaine, which is known, like L-DOPA or Tourette's, to raise the brain's dopamine. Thus Freud's startling comment about cocaine, that the sense of well-being and euphoria it induces in no way differs from the normal euphoria of the healthy person. In other words, you are simply normal, and it is soon hard to believe that you are under the influence of any drug. The same paradoxical valuation may attach to electrical stimulations of the brain. There are epilepsies which are exciting and addictive, and may be self-induced repeatedly by those who are prone to them. As rats with implanted cerebral electrodes compulsively stimulate the pleasure centers of their own brain. But there are other epilepsies which bring peace and genuine well-being. A wellness can be genuine even if caused by an illness. And such a paradoxical wellness may even confer a lasting benefit. We are in strange waters here, where all the usual considerations may be reversed, where illness may be wellness, and normality, illness, where excitement may be either bondage or release, and where reality may lie in ebriety, not sobriety. It is the very realm of Cupid and Dionysus. Chapter 12. A Matter of Identity. "What'll it be today?"
he says, rubbing his hands. Half a pound of Virginia, a nice piece of Nova. Evidently, he saw me as a customer. He would often pick up the phone on the ward and say, Thompson's Delicatessen?
Oh, Mr. Thompson, I exclaim. And who do you think I am?
Good heavens, the light's bad. I took you for a customer. As if it isn't my old friend Tom Pitkins.
Me and Tom, he whispers in an aside to the nurse, was always going to the races together.
Mr. Thompson, you are mistaken again.
So I am, he rejoins, not put out for a moment.
Why would you be wearing a white coat if you were Tom? You're Jaime, the kosher butcher next door.
No bloodstains on your coat, though. Business bad today? You'll look like a slaughterhouse by the end of the week.
Feeling a bit swept away myself in this whirlpool of identities, I finger the stethoscope dangling from my neck.
A stethoscope! He exploded. And you pretending to be Jaime? You mechanics are all starting to fancy yourselves to be doctors, what with your white coats and stethoscopes, as if you need a stethoscope to listen to a car. So, you're my old friend Manners from the mobile station at the block. Come in to get your bologna and rye.
William Thompson rubbed his hands again in his salesman grocer's gesture and looked for the counter. Not finding it, he looked at me strangely again.
Where am I?
He said with a sudden scared look.
I thought I was in my shop, doctor. My mind must have wandered. You'll be wanting my shirt off to sound me as usual?
No, not the usual. I'm not your usual doctor.
Indeed you're not. I could see that straight away. You're not my usual chest-thumping doctor. And by God, you've a beard. You look like Sigmund Freud. Have I gone bonkers round the bend?
No, Mr. Thompson, not round the bend. Just a little trouble with your memory. Difficulties remembering and recognizing people.
My memory has been playing me some tricks, he admitted. Sometimes I make mistakes. I take somebody for somebody else. What'll it be now, Nova or Virginia?
So it would happen with variations every time. With improvisations, always prompt, often funny, sometimes brilliant, and ultimately tragic. Mr. Thompson would identify me, misidentify, pseudo-identify me, as a dozen different people in the course of 5 minutes. He would whirl fluently from one guess, one hypothesis, one belief to the next, without any appearance of uncertainty at any point. He never knew who I was, or what and where he was, an ex-grocer, with severe Korsakoff's, in a neurological institution. He remembered nothing for more than a few seconds. He was continually disoriented. Abysses of amnesia continually opened beneath him, but he would bridge them nimbly by fluent confabulations and fictions of all kinds. For him, they were not fictions, but how he suddenly saw or interpreted the world. Its radical flux and incoherence could not be tolerated, acknowledged for an instant. There was instead this strange, delirious quasi-coherence, as Mr. Thompson, with his ceaseless, unconscious, quick-fire inventions, continually improvised a world around him. An Arabian Nights world, a phantasmagoria. A dream of ever-changing people, figures, situations, continual, kaleidoscopic mutations and transformations. For Mr. Thompson, however, it was not a tissue of ever-changing, evanescent fancies and illusion, but a wholly normal, stable, and factual world. So far as he was concerned, there was nothing the matter. On one occasion, Mr. Thompson went for a trip, identifying himself at the front desk as the Reverend William Thompson, ordering a taxi and taking off for the day. The taxi driver, whom we later spoke to, said he had never had so fascinating a passenger. For Mr. Thompson told him one story after another, amazing personal stories full of fantastic adventures. He seemed to have been everywhere, done everything, met everyone. I could hardly believe so much was possible in a single life, he said.
It is not exactly a single life, we answered.
It is all very curious, a matter of identity.
A very similar story is related by Luria in The Neuropsychology of Memory, in which the spellbound cab driver only realized that his exotic passenger was ill when he gave him, for a fare, a temperature chart he was holding. Only then did he realize that this Scheherazade, this spinner of 1,001 tales, was one of those strange patients at the Neurological Institute. Jimmy G., another Korsakoff's patient, whom I have already described at length, had long since cooled down from his acute Korsakoff syndrome and seemed to have settled into a state of permanent lostness, or perhaps a permanent, now-seeming dream or reminiscence of the past. But Mr. Thompson, only just out of hospital. His Korsakoff's had exploded just 3 weeks before, when he developed a high fever, raved, and ceased to recognize all his family, was still on the boil, was still in an almost frenzied, confabulatory delirium of the sort sometimes called Korsakoff's psychosis, though it is not really a psychosis at all, continually creating a world and self to replace what was continually being forgotten and lost. Such a frenzy may call forth quite brilliant powers of invention and fancy. A veritable confabulatory genius. For such a patient must literally make himself and his world up every moment. We have, each of us, a life story, an inner narrative, whose continuity, whose sense is our lives. It might be said that each of us constructs and lives a narrative, and that this narrative is us, our identities. If we wish to know about a man, we ask, what is his story? His real inmost story, for each of us, is a biography, a story. Each of us is a singular narrative, which is constructed continually, unconsciously, by, through, and in us, through our perceptions, our feelings, our thoughts, our actions, and not least, our discourse, our spoken narrations. Biologically, physiologically, we are not so different from each other. Historically, as narratives, we are each of us unique. To be ourselves, we must have ourselves, possess, if need be, repossess our life stories. We must recollect ourselves, recollect the inner drama, the narrative of ourselves. A man needs such a narrative. A continuous inner narrative to maintain his identity, his self. This narrative need, perhaps, is the clue to Mr. Thompson's desperate tale-telling, his verbosity. Deprived of continuity of a quiet, continuous inner narrative, he is driven to a sort of narrational frenzy. Hence his ceaseless tales, his confabulations, his mythomania. Unable to maintain a genuine narrative or continuity, unable to maintain a genuine inner world, he is driven to the proliferation of pseudo-narratives in a pseudo-continuity, pseudo-worlds peopled by pseudo-people, phantoms. What is it like for Mr. Thompson? Superficially, he comes over as an ebullient comic. People say he's a riot. And there is much that is farcical in such a situation, which might form the basis of a comic novel. It is comic, but not just comic, it is terrible as well. For here is a man who, in some sense, is desperate, in a frenzy. The world keeps disappearing, losing meaning, vanishing. And he must seek meaning, make meaning, in a desperate way. Continually inventing, throwing bridges of meaning over abysses of meaninglessness, the chaos that yawns continually beneath him. But does Mr. Thompson himself know this, feel this? After finding him a riot, a laugh, loads of fun, people are disquieted, even terrified by something in him. He never stops, they say,
He's like a man in a race, a man trying to catch something which always eludes him. And indeed, he can never stop running, for the breach in memory, in existence, in meaning is never healed, but has to be bridged, to be patched every second. And the bridges, the patches, for all their brilliance, fail to work because they are confabulations, fictions which cannot do service for reality, while also failing to correspond with reality. Does Mr. Thompson feel this? Or again, what is his feeling of reality? Is he in a torment all the while? The torment of a man lost in unreality, struggling to rescue himself, but sinking himself by ceaseless inventions, illusions, themselves quite unreal. It is certain that he is not at ease. There is a tense, taut look on his face all the while, as of a man under ceaseless inner pressure, and occasionally, not too often, or masked if present, a look of open, naked, pathetic bewilderment. What saves Mr. Thompson in a sense, and in another sense, damns him, is the forced or defensive superficiality of his life, the way in which it is, in effect, reduced to a surface, brilliant, shimmering, iridescent, ever-changing, but for all that, a surface, a mass of illusions, a delirium without depth. And with this, no feeling that he has lost feeling for the feeling he has lost. No feeling that he has lost the depth, that unfathomable, mysterious, myriad-leveled depth which somehow defines identity or reality. This strikes everyone who has been in contact with him for any time, that under his fluency, even his frenzy, is a strange loss of feeling. That feeling or judgment which distinguishes between real and unreal, true and untrue, one cannot speak of lies here, only of non-truth, important and trivial, relevant or irrelevant. What comes out torrentially in his ceaseless confabulation has finally a peculiar quality of indifference, as if it didn't really matter what he said or what anyone else did or said, as if nothing really mattered anymore. A striking example of this was presented one afternoon when William Thompson, jabbering away of all sorts of people who were improvised on the spot, said, "And there goes my younger brother Bob past the window," in the same excited but even and indifferent tone as the rest of his monologue. I was dumbfounded when, a minute later, a man peeked round the door and said, "I'm Bob. I'm his younger brother. I think he saw me passing by the window." Nothing in William's tone or manner, nothing in his exuberant but unvarying and indifferent style of monologue, had prepared me for the possibility of reality. William spoke of his brother, who was real, in precisely the same tone, or lack of tone, in which he spoke of the unreal. And now, suddenly, out of the phantoms, a real figure appeared. Further, he did not treat his younger brother as real, did not display any real emotion, was not in the least oriented or delivered from his delirium. But, on the contrary, instantly treated his brother as unreal, effacing him, losing him, in a further whirl of delirium, utterly different from the rare but profoundly moving times when Jimmy G., the lost mariner, met his brother, and while with him was unlost. This was intensely disconcerting to poor Bob, who said, "I'm Bob, not Rob, not Dob, to no avail whatever." In the midst of confabulations, perhaps some strand of memory, of remembered kinship or identity, was still holding or came back for an instant, William spoke of his elder brother, George, using his invariable present indicative tense. "But George died 19 years ago," said Bob aghast. "Aye, George is always the joker, William quipped, apparently ignoring or indifferent to Bob's comment, and went on blathering of George in his excited, dead way, insensitive to truth, to reality, to propriety, to everything. Insensitive, too, to the manifest distress of the living brother before him. It was this which convinced me, above everything, that there was some ultimate and total loss of inner reality, of feeling and meaning, of soul in William, and led me to ask the sisters, as I had asked them of Jimmy G, do you think William has a soul? Or has he been pithed, scooped out, desouled by disease? This time, however, they looked worried by my question, as if something of the sort were already in their minds. They could not say, judge for yourself, see William Chapel, because his wisecracking, his confabulations continued even there. There is an utter pathos, a sad sense of lostness, with Jimmy G, which one does not feel or feel directly with the effervescent Mr. Thompson. Jimmy has moods and a sort of brooding, or at least yearning sadness, a depth, a soul, which does not seem to be present in Mr. Thompson. Doubtless, as the sisters said, he had a soul, an immortal soul, in the theological sense, could be seen and loved as an individual by the Almighty. But they agreed something very disquieting had happened to him, to his spirit, his character, in the ordinary human sense. It is because Jimmy is lost that he can be redeemed or found, at least for a while, in the mode of a genuine emotional relation. Jimmy is in despair, a quiet despair, to use or adapt Kierkegaard's term, and therefore he has the possibility of salvation, of touching base, the ground of reality, the feeling and meaning he has lost, but still recognizes, still yearns for. But for William, with his brilliant, brassy surface, the unending joke which he substitutes for the world, which, if it covers over a desperation, is a desperation he does not feel. For William, with his manifest indifference to relation and reality caught in an unending verbosity, there may be nothing redeeming at all. His confabulations, his apparitions, his frantic search for meanings being the ultimate barrier to any meaning. Paradoxically, then, William's great gift for confabulation, which has been called out to leap continually over the ever-opening abyss of amnesia, William's great gift is also his damnation. If only he could be quiet, one feels, for an instant. If only he could stop the ceaseless chatter and jabber. If only he could relinquish the deceiving surface of illusions, then reality might seep in. Something genuine, something deep, something true, something felt could enter his soul. For it is not memory which is the final existential casualty here, although his memory is wholly devastated. It is not memory only which has been so altered in him, but some ultimate capacity for feeling which is gone. And this is the sense in which he is desouled. Luria speaks of such indifference as equalization, and sometimes seems to see it as the ultimate pathology, the final destroyer of any world, any self. It exerted, I think, a horrified fascination on him, as well as constituting an ultimate therapeutic challenge. He was drawn back to this theme again and again, sometimes in relation to Korsakov's and memory, as in the neuropsychology of memory, more often in relation to frontal lobe syndromes, especially in human brain and psychological processes, which contains several full-length case histories of such patients, fully comparable in their terrible coherence and impact to the man with a shattered world. Comparable, and in a way more terrible still because they depict patients who do not realize that anything has befallen them. Patients who have lost their own reality without knowing it. Patients who may not suffer, but be the most God-forsaken of all. Zazetsky in The Man with a Shattered World is constantly described as a fighter, always even passionately conscious of his state, and always fighting with the tenacity of the damned to recover the use of his damaged brain. But William is so damned he does not know he is damned, for it is not just a faculty or some faculties which are damaged, but the very citadel, the self, the soul itself. William is lost in this sense, far more than Jimmy, for all his brio. One never feels, or rarely feels, that there is a person remaining, whereas in Jimmy there is plainly a real moral being, even if disconnected most of the time. In Jimmy, at least, reconnection is possible. The therapeutic challenge can be summed up as only connect. Our efforts to reconnect William all fail, even increases confabulatory pressure. But when we abdicate our efforts and let him be, he sometimes wanders out into the quiet and undemanding garden which surrounds the home, and there, in its quietness, he recovers his own quiet. The presence of others, other people, excite and rattle him, force him into an endless, frenzied social chatter, a veritable delirium of identity-making and seeking. The presence of plants, a quiet garden, the non-human order, making no social or human demands upon him, allow this identity delirium to relax, to subside. And by their quiet, non-human self-sufficiency and completeness, allow him a rare quietness and self-sufficiency of his own. By offering, beneath or beyond, all merely human identities and relations, a deep, wordless communion with nature itself. And with this, the restored sense of being in the world, being real. Chapter 13. Yes, Father, Sister. Mrs. B., a former research chemist, had presented with a rapid personality change, becoming funny, facetious, given to wisecracks and puns, impulsive and superficial. "You feel she doesn't care about you," one of her friends said. "She no longer seems to care about anything at all." At first it was thought that she might be hypomanic, but she turned out to have a cerebral tumor. At craniotomy, there was found not a meningioma, as had been hoped, but a huge carcinoma involving the orbitofrontal aspects of both frontal lobes. When I saw her, she seemed high-spirited, volatile, a riot, the nurses called her, full of quips and cracks, often clever and funny. "Yes, Father," she said to me on one occasion. "Yes, Sister," on another. "Yes, Doctor," on a third. She seemed to use the terms interchangeably. "What am I?" I asked, stung, after a while. "I see your face, your beard," she said. "I think of an archimandrite priest. I see your white uniform, I think of the sisters. I see your stethoscope, I think of a doctor."
"You don't look at all of me."
"No, I don't look at all of you."
"You realize the difference between a father, a sister, a doctor?"
"I know the difference, but it means nothing to me. Father, sister, doctor, what's the big deal?" Thereafter, teasingly, she would say, "Yes, father, sister. Yes, sister, doctor," and other combinations. Testing left-right discrimination was oddly difficult because she said left or right indifferently, though there was not in reaction any confusion of the two, as when there is a lateralizing defect of perception or attention,
When I drew her attention to this, she said, "Left, right. Right, left. Why the fuss? What's the difference?"
"Is there a difference?" I asked.
"Of course," she said with a chemist's precision. "You could call them enantiomorphs of each other, but they mean nothing to me. They're no different for me. Hands, doctors, sisters," she added, seeing my puzzlement. "Don't you understand? They mean nothing, nothing to me. Nothing means anything, at least to me."
"And this meaning nothing," I hesitated, afraid to go on, "this meaninglessness, does this bother you? Does this mean anything to you?"
"Nothing at all," she said promptly, with a bright smile, in the tone of one who makes a joke, wins an argument, wins at poker. Was this denial? Was this a brave show? Was this the cover of some unbearable emotion? Her face bore no deeper expression whatever. Her world had been voided of feeling and meaning. Nothing any longer felt real or unreal. Everything was now equivalent or equal. The whole world reduced to a facetious insignificance. I found this somewhat shocking. Her friends and family did too, but she herself, though not without insight, was uncaring, indifferent, even with a sort of funny, dreadful nonchalance or levity. Mrs. B., though acute and intelligent, was somehow not present, de-souled as a person. I was reminded of William Thompson and also of Dr. P. This is the effect of the equalization described by Luria, which we saw in the preceding chapter and will also see in the next. Postscript. The sort of facetious indifference and equalization shown by this patient is not uncommon. German neurologists call it Witzelsucht, joking disease, and it was recognized as a fundamental form of nervous dissolution by Hewlings-Jackson a century ago. It is not uncommon, whereas insight is, and the latter, perhaps mercifully, is lost as the dissolution progresses. I see many cases a year with similar phenomenology, but the most varied etiologies. Occasionally, I am not sure at first if the patient is just being funny, clowning around, or schizophrenic. Thus, almost at random, I find the following in my notes on a patient with cerebral multiple sclerosis, whom I saw but whose case I could not follow up in 1981. She speaks very quickly, impulsively, and, it seems, indifferently, so that the important and the trivial, the true and the false, the serious and the joking, are poured out in a rapid, unselective, half-confabulatory stream. She may contradict herself completely within a few seconds. Will say, she loves music, she doesn't. She has a broken hip, she hasn't. I concluded my observation on a note of uncertainty. How much is cryptamnesia confabulation? How much frontal lobe indifference equalization? How much some strange schizophrenic disintegration and shattering flattening? Of all forms of schizophrenia, the silly happy, the so-called hebephrenic, most resembles the organic amnestic and frontal lobe syndromes. They are the most malignant and the least imaginable, and no one returns from such states to tell us what they were like. In all these states, funny and often ingenious as they appear, the world is taken apart, undermined, reduced to anarchy and chaos. There ceases to be any center to the mind, though its formal intellectual powers may be perfectly preserved. The end point of such states is an unfathomable silliness, an abyss of superficiality, in which all is ungrounded and afloat and comes apart.
Luria once spoke of the mind as reduced in such states to mere Brownian movement. I share the sort of horror he clearly felt about them, though this incites rather than impedes their accurate description. They make me think first of Borges's Funes and his remark, "My memory, sir, is like a garbage heap," and finally of the Dunciad, "The vision of a world reduced to pure silliness, silliness as being the end of the world. Thy hand, great anarch, lets the curtain fall, and universal darkness buries all." Chapter 14. The Possessed. In Witty Tiki Ray, I described a relatively mild form of Tourette syndrome, but hinted that there were severer forms of quite terrible grotesqueness and violence. I suggested that some people could accommodate Tourette's within a commodious personality, while others might indeed be possessed, and scarcely able to achieve real identity amid the tremendous pressure and chaos of Tourettic impulses. Tourette himself and many of the older clinicians used to recognize a malignant form of Tourette's, which might disintegrate the personality and lead to a bizarre, phantasmagoric, pantomimic, and often impersonatory form of psychosis or frenzy. This form of Tourette's, super Tourette's, is quite rare, perhaps 50 times rarer than ordinary Tourette syndrome, and it may be qualitatively different as well as far more intense than any of the ordinary forms of the disorder. This Tourette psychosis, this singular identity frenzy, is quite different from ordinary psychosis because of its underlying and unique physiology and phenomenology. Nonetheless, it has affinities, on the one hand, to the frenzied motor psychoses sometimes induced by L-DOPA, and, on the other, to the confabulatory frenzies of Korsakov psychosis. And like these, it can almost overwhelm the person. The day after I saw Ray, my first Touretter, my eyes and mind opened, as I mentioned earlier, when in the streets of New York, I saw no less than three Touretters, all as characteristic as Ray, though more florid. It was a day of visions for the neurological eye. In swift vignettes, I witnessed what might mean to have Tourette syndrome of ultimate severity. Not only tics and convulsions of movement, but tics and convulsions of perception, imagination, the passions of the entire personality. Ray himself had shown what might happen in the street. But it is not enough to be told. You must see for yourself. And a doctor's clinic or ward is not always the best place for observing disease. At least, not for observing a disorder which, if organic in origin, is expressed in impulse, imitation, impersonation, reaction, interaction, raised to an extreme and almost incredible degree. The clinic, the laboratory, the ward are all designed to restrain and focus behavior, if not indeed to exclude it altogether. They are for a systematic and scientific neurology, reduced to fixed tests and tasks, not for an open, naturalistic neurology. For this,